In Ghana, a controversial new law criminalizes homosexuality, and the LGBTQ community there is reeling.
It feels like your life is being sucked out every day. It feels like you do not belong.
I'm Marco Werman. Today we'll take you to Ghana for reactions as the Supreme Court there dismisses a challenge to that law. Also on the show, an exclusive interview with a commander from the Syrian Democratic Forces, what he thinks Syria needs right now.
A real and representative political process, which will lead to the new Syria.
And in Thailand, a new path to citizenship for refugees.
It's so bold that they can really serve as an inspiration for this region, but also on a global scale.
Plus, they are free and everywhere. The universal joy of finding a great stick. All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us this Wednesday. In the north of Syria along the border with Turkey, there's an autonomous region run by Kurds, and it is in a fragile position. The Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, was a reliable ally for Washington while the U.S. was fighting the Islamic State. Now, as the balance of power in and around Syria shifts, Turkey is in a position to exert a lot of influence. The Turkish government has long viewed the Kurds as an adversary, and Turkey is currently building up forces along the Syrian border for a possible incursion into Kurdish territory. That's according to American and Kurdish officials. The World's Shirin Jafari has been speaking with the top commander for the Kurdish forces in Syria and is here to tell us more. Shirin, who is this commander and what do we need to know about him?
General Mazlum Abdi is the top commander for the Syrian Democratic Forces in northeastern Syria. He's in his 50s, and I have always seen him in his military fatigues. Abdi is a very busy man these days. Since the sudden fall of the government of Bashar al-Assad 10 days ago, his army and his people face a whole list of new threats, including possible resurgence of ISIS and attacks from Turkey.
Well, we've said that Turkey is building up forces along the border. Why does Turkey see the Kurds as a threat?
Turkey sees the SDF as a threat because it considers it as an offshoot of a separatist group which has been fighting the Turkish government for years now.
So what did Abdi, this commander, say about the latest at the border with Turkey?
Turkey has been positioning its troops at the border with Syria, getting ready for a large-scale attack. When I spoke with Abdi yesterday, he told me that his main concern right now is around a border town called Kobani, which holds a lot of symbolic importance. Just a quick background here. In 2015, the Kurds were crucial in helping the U.S. forces fight against ISIS in Syria and in liberating Kobani from the group. Today, Abdi says he's hoping the U.S. continues its support for the SDF. Here's Abdi speaking through an interpreter.
We start our collaborations and our relationships with the United States from Kobani. And now this symbolic city, it is under threat, and it is a moral duty for the U.S. to protecting it also.
The U.S. has been helping the Kurds. Before I spoke with Abdi yesterday, the U.S. announced that it has brokered a ceasefire agreement between Turkey and the SDF. But these agreements seem very fragile and they can be broken at any moment.
Shirin, you also mentioned the threat from the so-called Islamic State. I thought ISIS, though, was more or less defeated. Help us understand what's going on there.
ISIS doesn't hold any territory in Syria, but it does exist. The SDF forces are in charge of guarding camps and prisons that hold thousands of former ISIS members and their families. There are more than a dozen of these across northeastern Syria. I visited some of them earlier this year. And, you know, the conditions at these camps are terrible. These prisoners and their families have been stuck there for years. Most of them are Syrians, but some of them are from Europe, Canada, and the U.S. Governments have been slow or reluctant to take these people back because they see them as a security threat. Abdi told me that he has information that ISIS is planning to attack these camps and prisons to free ISIS members and their families. I asked him if he feels confident that his forces can push them back.
Currently, I am confident about our ability to put these facilities and these sites under control. But over time, I think if these attacks keep happening against us, this will hint to a dangerous and risky situation.
Abdi says this will turn into a risky situation because his forces are stretched thin.
The Kurds now also have to work with a new government in Syria, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. It has previously been affiliated with al-Qaeda, and there are concerns about how it's going to treat different ethnic groups in Syria. How is Abdi feeling about the new leadership in Damascus?
Abdi told me he's optimistic. He said so far the words and actions of HTS seem to show that they are accepting of different ethnic groups in Syria, of which there are many. But he said these are early days and Syrians have a lot of work to do.
Syria needs constructive dialogue between all its people and a real and representative political process, which will lead to the new Syria. And everybody's rights will be respected constitutionally as the outcome of this political process.
Abdi is hoping that his corner of Syria stays in Kurdish hands.
And finally, Shirin, the U.S. presence there. I mean, the U.S. has troops on the ground in Syria supporting the Kurds in their fight against ISIS. Do we know if those U.S. troops will stay?
The U.S. has about 900 troops stationed at bases in Syria. The Biden administration says it's keeping them there for now. Their mission is to counter ISIS, and they have been doing that even in the past few days. But, you know, the U.S. is going through a political transition of its own. Donald Trump will take office next month, and we'll have to wait and see what his policy will be towards the Kurds and the American forces in Syria. Trump previously said on social media that, quote, Syria is not our fight, and that the U.S. should, quote, let it play out. I asked General Abdi if he has been in touch with Mr. Trump and his team. He said he has worked with Trump in the past, and he has been in touch with people close to him.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Explore more of what the top commander of Kurdish forces in Syria had to say. We have Shirin's full interview with him online at theworld.org, along with all of our coverage of the events in Syria. A widespread backlash against immigrants from Europe to the Middle East to the U.S. has brought about policy changes in numerous countries that make it harder for refugees to get in. But Thailand is taking a step in the other direction, offering a path to citizenship for nearly 500,000 stateless people within its borders. The U.N. has called the move historic. The Thai government puts it a little differently. They're calling it a New Year's gift. The World's Patrick Nguyen heads to the country's northern hills near the border with Myanmar, where people who stand to benefit are taking in the news.
I'm in a truck rumbling up a steep incline, rounding a hairpin curve. On windy mountain roads like this, you gotta blast the horn often to let anyone around the bend know a big truck is coming their way. I'm riding with a woman in her late 30s, Mifa Asong. She goes by Tha. Tha says, not long ago, this road was just gravel, not even paved. She grew up around here, in Chiang Mai province, in a cluster of hidden-away villages, a world apart from Thailand's neon-lit cities. These hilltops have been a refuge for minority groups fleeing chaos in Myanmar, a country often at war. It's only a few dozen miles away. Tha says, up here, you've got Akka, Lahu, Hmong, Lisu. Tha is Akka. These are all cross-border ethnic groups with their own languages and customs. What they don't always have is statehood. But starting in 2025, Thailand is giving almost 500,000 people citizenship or permanent residency, a path to citizenship. Seldom has any country given these rights to so many people in one go. Tha says, everyone up here is like, is this for real? She runs a nonprofit called the Local Community Network, helping people apply for statehood. Okay, we've reached our destination, a small village. Tha brings me to a bamboo hut clinging to the mountainside. Five people live here. Mom, dad, and three teenage daughters. They are from the Lahu minority. And one girl is in traditional Lahu dress, a black and red gown exquisitely woven with silver beads that jingle. There's no furniture, so we all sit on the creaky bamboo floor. Mom and Dad don't speak Thai so well, so the daughters do the talking. We are not like other people, says 15-year-old Mikila, the one in the ornate dress. We live simple lives. Everyone in the family works, picking coffee beans grown on the mountain slopes. One hard day brings in less than $10. We can't really handle a full day, says the oldest sister, 19-year-old Malik. After half a day, the girls get tired. Two of them are still in school, but the nearest high school is at the bottom of the mountain and up the road. Mali tells me many villagers here don't even speak Thai, so there's not much opportunity for them. Her parents escaped war-torn Myanmar decades ago, both as orphans. Some in that situation might have a few government documents, others have none. Many have had kids in Thailand but never got birth certificates. So there are whole villages living a little bit under the radar.
They can move around in the district where they live. They cannot move outside of that district without permission of district authorities.
That's Tammy Sharp with the United Nations Refugee Agency. She says Thailand's stateless population isn't persecuted, just stuck on the fringes of society.
They have the right to work, but the wages they're earning are much lower. They don't have the ability to own property, and this puts them also in a very socially, economic, vulnerable position.
Sharp says Thailand incorporating so much of its stateless population is groundbreaking, especially when the long-running conflict in Myanmar, the one that sent so many people escaping to Thailand, is worse than ever. Right now, huge numbers of people are still fleeing into this country illegally. Now, statehood is only on the table for those who escaped here decades ago and can prove it.
So these are not people who are coming in now. This is a very distinct population that have been living here for generations.
The Thai government has had to overcome internal fears that this policy will signal to refugees in Asia and around the world that Thailand is soft on illegal migrants. Sharp says it takes strong political will for Thai officials to go forward with this plan.
It's so bold that they can really serve as an inspiration for this region, but also on a global scale.
Back in the hut, the girls are singing one of their favorite songs, a love song in Lahu, their family's native language. There's not much to do up here, so this is how they pass the time. The family hopes to get citizenship next year, with Da, the woman who introduced me, helping them navigate the bureaucracy. I asked the oldest sister, Mali, how she's feeling about all this. She says, I'm happy that finally we can be like other people, people with papers, going wherever we want in peace. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Ban Pangkut Village, Thailand.
The largest embassy the U.S. has in the world was dedicated today in Mexico City. The U.S. spent more than $1 billion on that new embassy in Mexico. Ambassador Ken Salazar is leaving his post with the change of presidential administrations, but said today the new facility highlights a singular relationship between the U.S. and Mexico. Completion of the construction project has run 2 years over schedule, and it won't open to the public until late next year as work continues. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Patrick Nguyen, the world's correspondent in Bangkok, and wow, what a year. I've reported on North Korean hackers infiltrating American hospitals and military bases, continued violence against the Rohingya in Myanmar, and get this, an island called Bougainville that may soon be the next newest country on Earth. These stories are about real people facing extraordinary challenges, and they're not getting nearly enough attention. At The World, we believe in journalism that goes beyond the surface to show the human side of global events. And we're connecting the dots, showing you how decisions in Washington can have a big effect on events here in Southeast Asia, and vice versa, so you can see the bigger picture. In-depth reporting isn't easy. We can't do it without our listeners' support. As a nonprofit newsroom, we depend on listeners like you to help fund our work. Your donations pay for travel, measures to keep us safe in the field, and everything else me and my colleagues need to bring stories to life. We're quickly nearing the end of the year and our fundraising drive, and right now we have a great opportunity. A generous donor has pledged to match every donation one-to-one until December 31st, so your gift would go twice as far. If you value thoughtful, independent journalism that puts real people at the center of every story, please consider making a donation today. No amount is too small. Every dollar makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to make a gift. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Ghana, a controversial bill that criminalizes homosexuality has drawn international condemnation. As of today, it's one step closer to becoming law. Ghana's Supreme Court just dismissed a challenge to the bill's constitutionality.
It would be premature for this court to exercise its interpretive and enforcement jurisdiction to intervene.
Premature, says Justice Avril Lovelace Johnson, because a bill cannot be declared unconstitutional until it's been signed into law. Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Ghana's capital, Accra, has more on the reaction to today's decision.
The bill, called Promotion of Proper Human Sexual Rights and Ghanaian Family Values, proposes harsh penalties. 3 years in prison for anyone identifying as LGBTQ, and 5 years for those who speak out in support of LGBTQ rights. If signed into law, it could ignite a severe crackdown, putting activists and even journalists at risk and deepening discrimination across Ghana.
If LGBT people offend the law, deal with them. But to single out a group of people because you don't like their sexual or gender identity, that is what I find abhorrent.
Professor Emerita Abina Tichua Manu is a human rights activist and member of the Ghana Center for Democratic Development. We spoke shortly after the Supreme Court's verdict today. She said signing the bill into law could hurt Ghana's image as a democratic nation and lead to more human rights abuses. In Ghana, being perceived as gay can lead to violence. People are beaten, shamed on social media. Some are even forced into spiritual homes to be exorcised of so-called gay spirits. And the support for the anti-LGBTQ bill is overwhelming, with a recent survey showing 93% of Ghanaians wouldn't want LGBTQ neighbors. But Manu says democracy isn't just following the wishes of the majority.
It is also about protecting minorities. So the fact that you do not want an LGBT person as your neighbor does not mean that you're going to send somebody to jail just because the person says that they are gay or lesbian. No, that is not right.
But while the court's decision clears the path for the bill to move forward, its sponsors in parliament are not pleased. Legislator Emmanuel Kwesi Bezra says the Supreme Court justice's timing was poor.
You should have done that long ago for the president to sign. He has only 2 weeks to go. There's no need. There's no need at all.
President Akufo-Addo is set to step down on January 7 after serving 2 terms. He had held off on signing the bill, waiting for the court's ruling. Now, with his time in office winding down and the court's decision out, he is yet to decide what comes next. As for his successor, John Mahama has long opposed expanding LGBTQ plus rights. But President-elect Mahama hasn't made it clear whether he will sign the bill into law. Bezra says it will just need to wait for the next parliament.
And this bill will come, we'll pass it, and he will sign. And that will be his legacy to the glory of God.
This has left the country's LGBTQ community extremely worried.
Daunting, overwhelming, exasperating. It feels like, you know, your life is being sucked out every day. It feels like you do not belong.
Adam is a queer Ghanaian in Accra who wishes to be identified only by their first name out of concern for their own safety. They hope that President-elect Mahama will lead an inclusive government, one that embraces all Ghanaians, regardless of their sexual orientation.
We should, cultivate the spirit of, you know, understanding, the spirit of respect for everyone, and know that, you know, queer people are not your enemies. They are all around us.
For now, activists say The fight for LGBTQ rights in Ghana is far from over, as the entire nation awaits how the Supreme Court's judgment will shape Ghana's democratic future. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman, Accra, Ghana.
In the region of Catalonia in northeast Spain, there's a Christmas soup called Escudella de Nadal, literally Christmas in a bowl. That gives you a sense of just how big a holiday staple this soup is. And to call it hearty, that's an understatement. The world's Jerry Haddon hung out in the kitchen of a woman who's an old hand at making Escudella de Nadal and filed this postcard from the remote village of Llampaes, Spain.
With soup, usually you ask, what's in it? With the Escudella de Nadal, the question is, what's not?
Començant per la pastanaga, l'àpid, el nap I la xirivia.
78-year-old grandmother Colisa Camps Fresneda rattles off the ingredients, starting with the carrots, celery, turnips, parsnip, cabbage, potatoes.
Afegeix la pilota, la botifarra I la carn de vedella.
Then the meatballs, the botifarra sausage, says my gray-haired, ruddy-cheeked host, the beef, rabbit, a pig's foot, a ham bone, an ear. Camp's kitchen here in this tiny village of stone houses looks half butcher shop, half farmer's market, as she prepares to prepare this classic Catalan Christmas soup.
Es un plat molt llarg de fer.
The escudella, she says, takes a long time to make, but it's not complicated. If you don't go slow, she says, you'll regret it. Slow as in starting an entire day earlier, soaking chickpeas in a giant pot, then simmering them. And then, who knew, you have to frighten them.
Espantar vol dir aigua freda, una mica d'aigua freda.
Frightening the chickpeas, she explains, means adding cold water to the boil. That way they cook through without falling apart. Camps adds ingredient after ingredient to the pot. The aroma builds, the meat, the autumn veggies all mixed together. She's right, it does take a long time. But she goes through all this trouble each holiday season because her mom did, and her grandmother, and her great-great-grandmother.
El plat és ancestral.
It's an ancestral dish, she says, dating back to the Middle Ages. Started by monks, she says, who served it over macaroni. Camps will ladle hers over shell pasta, according to modern tradition, on Christmas Day, serving it to her kids and grandkids. With red wine and maybe an endive salad.
A totes les cases.
Every house has its escudella, Camp says. Rich or poor, cultured or not, this is a dish Catalan families wait for at Christmas. For the world, I'm Sherry Haddon, Llampaes, Spain.
Tis the season, don't you know, to break out those ugly Christmas sweaters. But hey, Grandma put love into every stitch, right? So just put it on. In the UK this holiday season, there are some knitted products that are adorned with public service announcements. Don't drink and dive. I did not misspeak. Don't drink and dive. A holiday message woven into a limited line of sweaters, slippers, and Speedos released by former Olympic diver and knitting aficionado Tom Daly in collaboration with the liquor company Malibu Rum. The campaign aims to encourage responsible drinking, especially near bodies of water. It comes in response to research from the Royal Life-Saving Society that shows 25% of drownings around winter holidays involve alcohol. So stay safe, stay warm, and please drink responsibly. Change in Syria means change for Lebanon.
It's a very tense moment, but one that is also rife with opportunities and threats and people looking to advance their interests.
And the stick of the year has been chosen.
The thing that makes a good stick is the overall aura, and it's something that really can't be explained.
He will try, though. That's still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Vanuatu, one of the Pacific Ocean's tiny island nations, is struggling to recover from a catastrophic earthquake that hit early Tuesday afternoon. The frantic search for survivors continues as the death toll continues to climb. Meanwhile, internet service is still down, power remains unstable, and organizations providing relief and essential services are completely overwhelmed. Reporter Nina Rao brings us a story from the Pacific island of Guam.
It was a regular sunny Tuesday afternoon at a waterfront cafe in Port Vila, the capital of Vanuatu. It's the most populated city in the archipelago nation, off the coast of Australia, when suddenly powerful tremors threw people to the ground, dishes and glassware shattering as they fell, and furniture swaying violently. This video of the 7.3 magnitude earthquake was sent to me by the cafe owner. The quake struck off the coast of Port Vila, leaving a trail of destruction, collapsing buildings and cutting off water and power to thousands. Its impact was felt beyond Vanuatu's largest city. About 36 miles away, retired Australian teacher Joanne Kafer describes the terrifying moment.
I was inside the house when the house started to jump. The rumbling came first. The noise was intense. The whole house just shook. And then I thought, I need to get under the table.
Kafer and her husband are safe, and her home didn't sustain any damage. But continual aftershocks and demolished roads have made it scary for her to leave the house. Back in the capital, Dr. Basil Leodoro says the situation is dire. He's the director of operations for the humanitarian vessel Helper One, which currently has a shore team based in Port Vila.
The amount of damage in Port Vila is staggering. We've never seen that kind of damage. We've never had to mount this kind of response before.
Leodoro is from Vanuatu, where earthquakes and extreme weather events are nothing new. The island nation is located on the seismically active Pacific Ring of Fire, which often leads to strong earthquakes. The UN deemed the country most vulnerable to natural disasters. This time, collapsed infrastructure is hindering recovery. Leodoro says power outages are complicating life-saving efforts.
Not only is re-establishing power dangerous for rescue efforts because of live wires, but we're also very concerned with power outages because of the electrical tools that are needed to rescue who are crushed under the rubble.
The other issue is connectivity. Telecommunications have not been fully restored, making rescue coordination efforts challenging for him.
I am only able to speak to you because we have Starlink that we use on board. And in fact, we have activated our mobile emergency operations center on board so that we can communicate with response teams.
But not everyone has access to it. That's why Finau Leveni with the International Federation for Red Cross Pacific says preparedness is key while awaiting clearer communication from Vanuatu.
We're doing a lot of coordination with our partners. For example, we know that two huge reservoirs have been damaged, which means likely that there will be no access to water. So we're looking at making sure that we've got emergency water, health and sanitation expertise on standby.
Meanwhile, Ivan Oswald, the owner of Number One Cafe from earlier, is stepping up for his community. His solar-powered Starlink-activated cafe is open for residents to use for free.
So the emergency services have been using that, and I'll put up a power board down there so they can plug their phones in. I mean, how could I not? I'm not doing it for any promotional reasons, just if people need it, especially emergency services down there. And if people can use it and call their friends and family and loved ones, that's the most important thing.
A resilient spirit, Oswald says, will help the small island nation rise once again. For the world, I'm Naina Rao, Guam.
For more than five decades, Syrians endured the brutal regime of the Assad family. But Syrians were not the only ones whose daily lives were shaken by that leadership. Next door in Lebanon, the influence of Syria's government has also long been evident. Sami Halabi is director of policy with the Alternative Policy Institute in the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
Syria has typified and exemplified and affected our politics for over 53 years. I mean, the politics of Syria and the politics of Lebanon are very much intertwined. And so, you know, most parties and people are reluctant to step out of line with, you know, their previous positions. But at the same time, everyone realizes that things will never be the same. So it's a very tense moment, but one that is also rife with opportunities and threats and people looking to advance their interests. So I would say that there's a mix of cautious optimism and underlying anxiety.
So let's take that apart bit by bit, starting with Hezbollah. I mean, the paramilitary group has been supported by Iran. It's based in Lebanon, had been an important ally of Assad. So what's happening with Hezbollah now that Assad is gone?
I think Hezbollah is trying to do some soul searching. It's trying to send signals to other Lebanese parties that it's willing to negotiate on national defense because it knows its survival is contingent on that negotiation. You know, Syria was a very, very important supply line to Hezbollah coming in from Iran, weapons, and then moving through Syria and then coming to Lebanon. That's going to be hampered, to say the least, right now. And so they're seeing what cards they still have to play. At the same time, I think, so we're in for a complex and messy transition, I think, for Hezbollah. But I also think that the party has been very pragmatic in the past when it came to its own survival and is able to adapt politically. The hope is that other parties in Lebanon, if there are such overtures from Hezbollah, are able to react adequately and not try to wipe out the party, because it has widespread support and that could set up Lebanon for more civil strife.
Yeah, no, clearly. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that is not settled right now. What about the political parties in Lebanon that are rivals of Hezbollah and opposed to Assad? Should they feel confident? Like, what are they saying?
I think they do feel confident at the moment. This is an opening for them on this issue, you know, pro and anti Hezbollah issue, or pro and anti, you know, weapons of Hezbollah, more accurately, that they haven't had for a very long time. So they will take this opportunity to make as many gains as possible. But I also think that, you know, after many, many decades of a regime in Syria having such widespread influence in Lebanon, that changing also changes the calculus of other parties and even the parties as opposed to Hezbollah. They also understand that what emerges in Syria might be a form of government that's not necessarily aligned with them either.
How are people in Lebanon reacting to the return of Syrian refugees? And how do you think the departure of refugees will impact Lebanon?
Look, I mean, the issue of refugees in Lebanon is quite a divisive one. I think the Lebanese over-indexed the effect of the refugee crisis on their politics and their situation. Of course, the political powers are very happy to scapegoat Syrian refugees for all the problems in Lebanon. I think that's probably the only thing they do agree on. And in that sense, I believe that most Lebanese people will be very happy to see Syrians returning to their country, not because they think it's better for Lebanon, because it's better for everyone. I mean, it's amazing to see the joy on the faces of Syrians when they return to their country that they haven't been able to safely return to for over a decade now. I mean, a lot of this is a moment of joy in many senses. So we shouldn't lose sight of that. There is some cause for optimism, and we should remain positive that this can turn out well, but it will require cooler heads and a lot more diplomatic effort on the side of all parties, but especially to rein in the Israelis, because the Israelis and their actions could make things much more complicated and really sway public opinion against any kind of resolution in the short term.
Daily life for Lebanese, though, has also been held captive by the 2019 financial crisis. What do you think the fall of the Assad regime could mean for the Lebanese economy?
Well, look, I mean, if all goes well, which, you know, is going to be a pretty optimistic view, Lebanon will gain very much from any reconstruction effort that takes place in Syria. I mean, Lebanon has always been the marketplace of Syria, the bank of Syria, the ports of Syria. You know, Syria's infrastructure has been decimated by 13 years of war. There's, you know, widespread destruction. The reconstruction of Syria would be a gargantuan task, but it would be a gargantuan investment. And the Lebanese know how to rebuild after a civil war. So I think the Lebanese economy could have, you know, if we manage to keep it together, we could have a peace dividend from all of this. But that will take time. It will take lifting of sanctions, recognition of governments. It will take a massive effort on the part of all the players in Syria, be it from the Iranian and Russian side to the GCC and the West, to really invest in reconstruction. And that will require a big deal to be had, especially with Turkey, who's holding a lot of the cards in Syria right now.
So, I mean, there is a wait-and-see factor to how the change in Syria will change Lebanon. But generally, how much optimism is there in Lebanon about the country's future at this juncture?
I think the Lebanese are pretty realistic about where we are at the moment. As you said, there was a financial crisis in 2019 that's still very much unresolved. So most of the wealth of the country is stuck in the banks. They're not expecting somebody to come in on a white horse and save them. So I think the Lebanese are happy that they're not in a war with Israel anymore. There's a large relief, a sigh of relief at least. But there's also a realization that the road ahead is not going to be easy. Hopefully, there will be a president elected at the next parliament session, which is in early January. And then appointments can happen and a deal can move forward. And maybe, just maybe, the Lebanese parties can start to, you know, plan their policies and their positions based on the interests of Lebanon. But, you know, for the most part, history hasn't shown that to be the case. I think a lot of parties in Lebanon will wait to see what their international patrons will do and follow course. And that will mean that Lebanon's politics will reflect the wider geopolitics in the region.
Just finally, Sami, if you can just cast your thinking over the past 18 months or so to what's happened in Israel, Gaza, Lebanon, Iran, and now Syria. Do you have a sense of whether things are overall getting better for people in those countries?
So, you know, sometimes things have to get worse before they get better. I think that, you know, what's happened in Gaza is a tragedy to no end. What's happened in Lebanon is a reckoning with, you know, for the Lebanese and how we want to build our future. And what's happened in Syria is probably one of the most unprecedented falls of a regime since the Soviet Union. In that kind of, you know, shifting sands, a lot of people sink, a lot of people stand. Things are going to look very different, you know, moving forward. So I think people are better off in the sense that they see some kind of horizon. Now things are moving. So in that sense, I think people agree that things needed to move forward and now they're moving. And now we're in this, you know, cautious optimism and underlying anxiety phase. And I think it's better than the stagnation. But then again, we know how things can turn out. So we have to see where the chips fall.
Sami Halabi spoke to us from Beirut. He's the director of policy at the Alternative Policy Institute. In rural Nebraska, cultivating the soil and raising animals are both part of one family's national and cultural identity. The work has helped preserve traditional Brazilian food cultivation in the American Midwest. Nebraska Public Media's Cassidy Arena has a story.
They go into little...
Well, we're going to see 300 animals in here, so...
Sandro Lopez walks through his farm with his daughter Maria on a windy day in David City. Maria points out the different vegetables and flowers. She names off each of her goats.
My dad thought Chico would really fit the name for this one, which does. Don't eat the bark. And we got Kendrick over here.
Lopez learned a lot about farming and goats from a free program with the Center for Rural Affairs that was offered to Latino farmers in Nebraska and Iowa. Lucia Schultz is a community organizing associate with the center and the lead on the program. She says often the resources for South American farmers focus solely on South American climates.
Which is, there's nothing wrong with that, but our climate is so different from South America climates.
She adds the center noticed an increased need for this class after one of their YouTube videos received an unexpectedly high number of views. And then Schultz started getting more and more messages over WhatsApp, a popular messaging app for Latinos. That led to the center offering an 8-month-long program in Spanish as well as English, which included perspectives with cultural relevance.
It's very important for us, that equity and inclusivity piece. So we want everybody to know that they're always welcome.
Lopez says these classes have taught him valuable lessons in how to sustain his own farm while honoring his cultural roots. And on that point, he says he's not a farmer, rather a cabac, or an Afro-Indigenous Brazilian who lives near the river and respects agriculture. Lopez applied the knowledge he gained through the program to the ways his mother grew food in her community.
Grandma is Ekunyankarai. Ekunyankarai means counselor, a spiritual leader. So basically the knowledge that was passed from grandpa, great-grandpa, is through her, and I'm learning a little bit from her because I didn't grow up in the rainforest like her. So Maria is going to be very important and to continue. And then she's going to show the next generation how the Kabak community grow food.
This connection between food production and identity isn't something just important to the Lopez family. Studies show food is a way for people to feel connected to their heritage. Catherine Wright has her PhD in public health. She focuses her research on cultural food security.
Really, it's the food ways, which is the preparing, sharing, and consuming of, you know, cultural food. We found were the key connectors between cultural food security and identity. So these practices were essential for cultural transmission, social connection, and a sense of belonging, which helped preserve and enhance cultural identities.
Lopez says preservation of their heritage comes with a few challenges, though. 91% of David City is white, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Lopez is proud that Maria is the only Latina in her school's 4-H club.
My ducks, the one that won second place, got 2 awards, a purple badge and a light purple badge for second place.
Along with teaching Maria, Lopez also shares his knowledge with the people around David City. He likes to share the extra foods his farm produces with his neighbors and the food bank. He talked about what makes his farm different from others in the region by exemplifying the different systems, often with Tupi names, in his family's native practices.
One we call Hossa. Hossa means local food system, basically. Another system we have is under the trees, they call the rainforest garden system. And there is another full sun here that we have the Muvuka system. Muvuka in Tupi means a party, or it's like a reunion of a lot of species in the same area.
Her father's cultural farming technique has had such an impact on Maria, she started her own TikTok account to share how her family cultivates food on social media.
Which one is the ducks duck is the...
On the door?
This one.
This one? I like this one.
My dad likes this one. He likes the sound.
He says he enjoys seeing Maria emulate the spiritual practices his mother taught him by building deeper relationships with nature, something that he knows will play a part as she grows up.
She can be a better human in the future, showing respect for the animals and for the land or for the trees. Or that's the important thing that for me and for our people is like, how can we be better humans? So there is a word for that. It's Nyembojera. It's being together, learning together.
Next year, Lopez says he wants Maria to be the face of their small farm business and teach other people how the Kabak community thrives, even in rural Nebraska. For The World, I'm Cassidy Arena, David City, Nebraska.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. If you're looking for a little light in the darkness this winter, our next story from the city of Lviv in western Ukraine transforms the hardship and brutality of war into something else entirely. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
On an evening last month, the central hall of the Lviv railway station filled with people, but they weren't there to catch a train. On a platform off to the side, an organist was warming up. Her instrument looks like a traditional church organ. It's a moment before you notice the tops of the silver pipes. Instead of ending in an elegant swoop or decorative crown, like usual, the tops are jagged shards. They're mangled, bent, twisting in on themselves. This organ is the work of Ukrainian artist Zhanna Kadyarova. She fashioned the silver pipes from the fragments of Russian artillery shells that were fired on Ukraine during the war. She collected them from the area around Kyiv, where she lives. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Kadyarova's work has depicted the horrors of war. The material for her installations are the debris of war. Squares of asphalt scarred by shrapnel, ceramic tiles fractured by gunshots, sheet metal riddled with bullet holes, or in this case, twisted fragments of Russian missiles. Her work isn't just a representation of violence, one critic said. It's a trace of the violence itself. At the Lviv station on that evening in November, Kadyarova said a few words to the audience. The instrument was behind her, lit from above. Everything else was dark.
Як символ єднання, тобто єднання, продовження життя і продовження творення.
This is a symbol of unity, she says, pointing to the instrument, a sign of the continuation of life amid war. The organist Alicia Borsuk began to play a composition she wrote specially for the instrument. The music speaks to violence, disruption, and transformation. It begins discordant before giving way to something more plaintive and somber. In her speech that night, the artist Zhanna Kadyarova went on to say, art still has power. At the beginning of the war, I didn't believe it, she says, but now I do. We are showing that we can live during a war, she says, that we continue to create and continue to support each other. The performances at the Lviv railway station will continue through January. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
If I go on a hike, one of the first things I'll be doing is looking for a good walking stick. And I'm not alone. An online community known as Stick Nation counts some 3 million followers on an Instagram account where people from across the globe share really cool sticks they found. They're like movie reviews or book reviews, but for sticks.
Hi, Stick Nation. I am Ajesh from Kerala, India. I found this beautiful stick.
If you can see, the stick is completely smooth, allowing for a really nice walk.
Just wandering through the woods here in southern Brazil.
and we found this very nice stick.
Well, Stick Nation just held its first ever Stick of the Year contest. The founders of the Instagram account that started it all join us from Utah to share the results. Boone Hobb and Logan Juggler, thank you for being here.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Let's get right into it. You've just announced the Stick of the Year, a coveted title, if ever there was one. The final vote, I hear, was neck and neck. This is the runner-up with a stick from Poland.
Hello, Stick Nation. I'm here in Poland, and I found this cool stick at my grandpa's house. You could use it at a club or a weapon, and I think it's pretty cool.
So, Boone, describe the stick for us, and just a little analysis of what it has going for it, other than its possible use as a weapon, maybe?
Yeah, so right off the bat, what I was struck by initially was, if you look at the base of it, it looks like it could be sawed off, so that would be what we call a modded stick in Stick Nation. That's a modified stick, which typically our audience likes to see natty sticks, all natural sticks. So I was quite surprised that a possibly modded stick had made it to the finals, but you don't see a stick like that every day. That looks very rare. So I thought it was an awesome runner-up and a wonderful representation of Poland. So
modded. So Stick Nation has its own lexicon.
Correct. Yeah. Modded, modified, natty, natural.
All right. So every contest obviously has its winner. Let's hear the winning submission, this one from Canada.
This is Marcus from Vancouver Island. I present to you an ancient energy sword. This thing's like the most majestic piece of driftwood I've ever seen. It's like fully split in two. Love this like flamey looking tip on the end. And like clearly hosts a ton of energy in this area here. And just handles so nicely.
Yeah, I got to hand it to him. I mean, from the description alone, it sounds so cool. Logan, what do you think he means when he talks about the energy of the stick? Is that an important consideration? Do you think about that?
Yeah, definitely. In Stick Nation, we call it the aura of the stick. And it's debatably the most important attribute that a stick can have. There's all sorts of different types of sticks, and they all have different characteristics. But really, the thing that makes a good stick is something that really can't be explained. But this stick, anyone that kind of sees it and sees the video, I think there's a reason that it won, because it has such unbelievable aura.
Yeah, I mean, how do you kind of just compare it to the stick we heard from Poland?
They're both great. They both definitely have a different style about them. I think the Ancient Energy Sword just has a little bit more of a rare energy and just a little bit better handleability from what it seems like. Seems like it would be a little bit more fun to swing around. Both great sticks, though.
How many stick reviews do you get per day?
We get hundreds. Since we've started till now, I think we have over 400 gigabytes of sticks, and that's not an exaggeration.
Well, as we've heard, you've got stick enthusiasts from all over the globe. Does Stick Nation give people a peek into other cultures or faraway landscapes?
Yeah, that's one of the things I've really appreciated, seeing people from all over the world and seeing the different kind of environments and different parts of the world. People from different cultures use sticks in ceremonial purposes. So we've gotten some that are like culturally relevant sticks.
Yeah, and you get to see some pretty cool botany. There's this one guy with a stick that has just a bunch of thorns all over it. He keeps it by his bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that guy's great.
I would.
Yeah, he was out in the jungle too, so he needs it.
Exactly. You guys display some really great sticks on your Instagram, sticks that people are reviewing, things that look like wizard staffs. Do you ever get jaded, though, and just like look at a stick and it's like, eh, I've seen better?
Honestly, we see so many sticks. That probably happens sometimes, but the majority of the sticks that we get are pretty cool, honestly. You know, the ones that tend to stick out to us are the more kind of rare looking ones, or the more like magic wizard staff looking ones.
It must be hard to stay away from all the puns.
Yeah, there's a lot to be made. There are a lot. Stick to it, stick together, find your roots, all of them.
That's Boone Hobb and Logan Juggler in Utah, bringing people together across the globe, united by a love of sticks. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. As always, thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world.